From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about Homeland Security with journalist Matthew Brzezinski, author of the new book, Fortress America. In the cover story of the current edition of Mother Jones, he writes that the Bush administration's obsession with Iraq has come at the direct expense of Homeland Security. Then we'll hear from Norman Podhoretz, who praises the administration for its handling of the war. Podhoretz was a liberal until he had a change of heart and became one of the founding fathers of neoconservatism. His latest article in the journal Commentary is titled World War IV, How It Started, What It Means, and Why We Have to Win. And linguist Jeff Nunberg compares how we describe Republicans and Democrats. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Militants have seized a school in southern Russia and are holding several hundred people hostage, many of them children and their parents. NPR's Lawrence Sheets is at the scene near the border with Chechnya.
The situation as it stands now is that the gunmen control the building, they control the school. The reports that we have are that there are approximately 400 people inside the school. There were some other reports saying that those numbers may be as low as 130, but according to local officials here, they believe that there are at least 400 people inside the school. The gunmen are holding them hostage, and that's where we stand right now. They've made it very clear that if Russian forces, Russian commandos, try to storm that building, then they will blow up the school.
NPR's Lawrence Sheets in southern Russia. At the Republican convention tonight, Vice President Dick Cheney will accept his party's nomination for a second term. He's expected to praise the president and deliver a very tough attack on Senator John Kerry, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
In excerpts the campaign released in advance of Cheney's speech tonight, the vice president frames the election as a debate about America's role in the world. He says the differences between Senator Kerry and President Bush are the sharpest, and the stakes for the country are the highest. Although Cheney's own approval ratings have fallen over the last 4 years, with the number of voters viewing him unfavorably more than doubling, Cheney continues to play an invaluable role in the campaign, delivering the kind of sharp attacks on Kerry that the president himself chooses not to. Republican delegates will also hear from Democratic Senator Zell Miller of Georgia tonight. Miller has all but broken with his own party and is supporting President Bush's re-election this year. Mara Liasson, NPR News, at the Republican convention in New York.
The Justice Department is asking a federal judge to set aside the convictions in the nation's first criminal trial of terrorism suspects. The government says federal prosecutors improperly withheld evidence. Quinn Kleinfelter has more from Detroit Public Radio.
Last year, a Detroit jury found two Arabic men guilty of plotting terror attacks on targets ranging from the Queen Aliyah Hospital in Jordan to Disneyland. But now the government wants the terrorism charges dropped because it says there isn't enough evidence to support them. Defense attorney William Swore says the prosecutor in the case withheld evidence that could have helped clear the defendants. A federal judge will decide later this week whether to void the convictions, which the Bush administration once hailed as an important victory in the war on terror. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
The U.S. military is not commenting on reports that U.S. warplanes carried out an airstrike on a target in the Iraqi city of Fallujah today. The Associated Press quotes hospital officials as saying the strike killed 9 civilians and wounded 6 others. In stocks, the Dow lost 5 to close at 10,168. The Nasdaq gained 12 to close at 1850. This is NPR News. French Muslim leaders are on their way to Iraq to demand the release of two French journalists who are being held hostage by militants. The militants have threatened to harm the two men unless France rescinds its ban on Muslim headscarves in public schools. France has refused to change the law, which takes effect tomorrow. At the United Nations Security Council prepares to meet tomorrow to talk about Sudan, Secretary General Kofi Annan called for more international troops to monitor the crisis in Darfur. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The UN Security Council demanded a month ago that Sudan rein in the Arab militias that it unleashed in a counterinsurgency campaign in the western provinces of Darfur. In a report prepared by his special envoy, Secretary General Annan said that Khartoum had failed to stop the so-called Janjaweed militias from attacking civilians. The report did not mention imposing sanctions on Sudan, though the Security Council resolution had held out that possibility. Instead, Annan's report called for an immediate increase in the international monitoring force in Darfur. There are currently just a few hundred African Union troops there to protect ceasefire monitors. Sudan has rejected the African Union's offer to send in several thousand peacekeepers. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Authorities in Florida are telling about 500,000 people in Florida to be ready to evacuate before the approach of Hurricane Frances. The Category 4 storm is now battering the Turks and Caicos Islands and moving toward the southeastern Bahamas. Forecasters say Frances is about 2 days away from the U.S. coast, but it's not clear where it might come ashore. Florida residents are still cleaning up from Hurricane Charley. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Walmart, committed to providing its associates a variety of career paths, training resources, and advancement opportunities. Information at walmartstores.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Matthew Brzezinski, has been writing about Homeland Security for nearly 3 years. He's concluded that the Department of Homeland Security has been crippled by a lack of funding and political support. Brzezinski is the author of the new book Fortress America and contributes to the New York Times Magazine. He also wrote the cover story in the current edition of Mother Jones, in which he makes the case that Homeland Security has taken second place to the Bush administration's obsession with Iraq. The Department of Homeland Security is composed of 22 formerly separate agencies, has 186,200 employees, and a budget of $27 billion. The money goes to screening airline passengers, inspecting trucks and shipping containers, making arrests and drug seizures, reviewing intelligence reports, watching over 8,000 federal facilities, ports, power plants, tunnels, and bridges, and more. The department was billed as the most ambitious government overhaul since the creation of the Pentagon. When Brzezinski paid a visit to its headquarters at the Nebraska Avenue complex of the Washington Naval District, he was expecting to find a colossus, but he could barely find the building at all. He finally located the entrance at the end of a little alley. The unimpressive nature of the headquarters reinforces Brzezinski's skepticism about how well equipped the department is to fulfill its mission.
Well, I mean, I think it told me that it's a bit of a game of smoke and mirrors, that there's clearly a reluctance to start this department, that it's sort of a child of political expediency where a great many people in Congress wanted it. The public was, you know, clamoring for the government to be seen as though it was doing something to protect the American people. And I think the White House was rather reluctant to unleash this sort of a monster. I mean, for perhaps ideological reasons, they're against, you know, big government, and this is clearly an example of big government. And also for very practical reasons, if you create an agency this size, you have to give up oversight to Congress, whereas if you keep it within the White House as just a sort of a policy unit, which is what it was before, you can do a lot of things very quietly on the sly and without a great deal of oversight and scrutiny from outside political forces. So, I mean, it's a bit of the sort of very cynical political game that's played in Washington, that, you know, that you can, at the same time, be the largest government agency in the United States and at once also, you know, have your head office, which literally looks like, I don't know, the janitorial department of a junior college. It's frightening.
You've reached the conclusion that Homeland Security is very inadequately funded. What are some of the areas that you think are most in need of more money in order to protect us?
I think that airline security, for instance, we've done a reasonably good job of making sure that nobody with box cutters is going to walk on a plane again. However, while we make a big show of patting down little old ladies and even kids, and we could be sitting on a bomb, because the behind the scenes which is screening the baggage and things like that, which are far less visible to the general public, just hasn't seemed to capture the imagination of the government as much. And we would roughly need around $3 billion to hire, it's in the neighborhood of 20-odd thousand baggage screeners and of course, buy the sort of EDS, larger-type EDS screening machines that could screen all this baggage. And there is no money for this, and there's very little political will to get a program like this off the ground. So that's clearly one area. Screening for weapons of mass destruction at ports, major ports of entry, both land and sea. Purchasing of detection equipment for such as anti-radiation screening materials and things like that. Purchasing equipment, particularly radios for first responders. Right now, first responders can't even talk to each other because they're not on the same frequencies. And we saw in 9/11, of course, that could lead to unnecessary loss of life. And so this is a very large area. They're extremely underfunded, and they're looking at budget cuts, in fact. In terms of biological and chemical responses, I think we need greater money to be sunk into detection equipment. The FBI is extremely underfunded as well, and its counterterror operations, in fact, they requested an extra $12 million to hire some counter terror analysts, and were turned down because there's just so little money. So it really runs the gamut.
In your Mother Jones cover story, you have a chart you put together where you compare the spending needs of Homeland Security with the amount of money that we're spending in Iraq. Do you want to describe what you've done in this chart, how you've compared the two?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, all told, we're spending about, so far at least, and the meter's still running, about $150 billion in Iraq. And there is extremely little money left over in the kitty for us to spend shoring up our defenses here at home. So we looked at sort of, you know, what would be needed to properly secure certain areas, everything from trains and subways, which the estimate is $6 billion. And that's about equivalent of about 20 days spending in Iraq. And what we've actually spent, which is about $100 million, which is 8 hours of, we spend that in 8 hours in Iraq. Things like radiation portals. We need just under $300 million, which is very, very little money for a country this size. And we spend that in less than a day in Iraq. And in fact, we've spent only $43 million, which is about, we go through that and burn through that in about 3 hours in Iraq.
Radiation portals are to check for
For weapons of mass destruction, mm-hmm. dirty bombs, nuclear-grade materials that might be smuggled into ports and so on and so forth, yes. Everything from, you know, from firefighters, as we said, that's really the biggie, $36 billion, which is 120 days worth of Iraqi occupation. And we've only allotted $500 million, which we spend in Iraq in less than 2 days. So emergency medical training is, we need $1.4 billion, and we've only allotted, well, we've actually chopped that to nothing, but we had only allotted $50 million, which we go through in a few hours in Iraq. And it just seems that, you know, that really all the resources are being diverted abroad, and there's very, very little left over for us to properly secure ourselves here at home.
Could you say with any certainty that if we weren't spending that $150 billion on the war in Iraq, that we would instead be spending that on Homeland Security? Would the money still not exist for Homeland Security, even if we weren't spending it in Iraq?
That's a very good question. I can't tell you what the administration would ultimately allot. However, given the dire sort of financial straits of the budget right now, it basically makes it a lot easier for them to say, no, we just don't have the money to spend on a lot of these things. I think, you know, if we weren't in Iraq, there'd be a lot more money available, and we'd definitely be much more likely to spend more, perhaps not as much as everyone would like, but certainly more than we're spending right now.
I'm sure people who support the war in Iraq would say, well, the money for Homeland Security is perhaps less necessary because we're taking care of some of the problem by being in Iraq, and in the long run, that will make Homeland Security less of a problem because it is helping to win the war on terrorism.
Well, I I'd have to disagree. There's so far there's been very little evidence that going into Iraq had anything to do with the war on terror. And there is, however, a great deal of evidence that by going into Iraq, by essentially invading an oil rich Arab country, we have done great harm to our reputation abroad, particularly in the Muslim world. And we've done a great service to Osama bin Laden. And public opinion poll after public opinion poll has shown that America's standing in that part of the world has just plummeted. And this, of course, means that there's a greater potential pool of recruits for al-Qaeda out there. And I think there is clear evidence that more people today want to do us harm than immediately right after 9/11 or before 9/11. So we are at a greater danger today than we were before we went into Iraq. And we've left ourselves, we've left a soft underbelly to our shield is the one here on the front lines at home.
Now, another financial comparison you make is that the FBI's entire 2005 budget is less than a third of the value of Halliburton's $17 billion contracts to rebuild the Iraqi infrastructure. How do you interpret that?
This again, is something that, you know, how do you place a premium or a value on the priorities of the White House? And clearly, you know, in Washington, one of the ways that different government agencies establish the pecking order and put them, determine where they fall on the totem pole is by how much money they receive. And I think it's rather tragic that the FBI, which is, you know, one of our frontline agencies in terms of protecting ourselves, is getting only a fraction of what Halliburton and all its subsidiaries are getting to provide Iraqis with subsidized gas and $30 hamburgers for our own troops and things like that. And in at a time of scarce resources, I'm not sure that that's the wisest allocation of resources.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Matthew Brzezinski, and his new book is called Fortress America. It's about homeland security. The federal government is giving cities money to help them deal with homeland security. What is the system? What is the equation for dividing up that money?
Well, there really isn't one, unfortunately, in terms of one that makes sense.
I said cities. I should have said states.
It could be cities and states, but it's basically on a population basis. And this is one of the great criticisms that's been leveled against the Department of Homeland Security, is that, you know, here we are, now well into, they've been in business since March of last year, so a year and a half they've been operating, and there's still no list of sort of priorities, which might indicate that, hey, New York City and Washington should be higher up on the list of potential targets than, you know, Des Moines, Iowa, or Juneau, Alaska. And yet, if you look at it, you know, and as things break down, those places are getting more money from Washington.
Let me quote a couple of statistics that you've given. Alaska and North Dakota get twice as much federal anti-terror funding per capita as New York. Wyoming gets four times more funding per capita than California. What's the explanation for those figures?
There really isn't much of a logical explanation, and it's just that everybody has to, you know, they're divvying up the pot, and they're trying to be, I guess, democratic about it, that everybody has to get a slice of this. And of course, there's the lobbying that comes into play. Where the local congressmen and senators are like, well, we need our slice of the homeland security pie. And it's just like military spending, where the contracts have to be broken up into all kinds of different states. But in terms of the logic, it makes very little sense. The only say piece of infrastructure in Alaska that is a danger is, of course, the pipeline and the oil terminals, and we should protect those. And in fact, we should force the oil companies to pay for that, because after all, it is their own. This is private property, and they're the ones who are ultimately going to pay if the terrorists blow it up. So there's really no reason to be spending a lot of money, on Juno per se. There's no targets there, and same thing, in places like Wyoming and whatnot. So very little of it makes sense, and it's just the way that the world works in Washington, and partly because of lobbying.
My guest is journalist Matthew Brzezinski. His new book is called Fortress America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Matthew Brzezinski. His new book about homeland security is called Fortress America. He also wrote this month's cover story in Mother Jones magazine. Now, in your book, you describe a terrorist plan by two plotters that was uncovered in Manila back in 1995. And their files were almost a blueprint for the September 11th attacks. What led the authorities in the Philippines to this plot?
It's an astonishing story, actually, something that could make a script for a movie. There was one evening in a sort of a downtown police station in Manila, there was a sort of a very charismatic, stubborn policewoman who was the watch commander. And around 11:30 at night or something, they got a call that there was some smoke coming out of one of the nearby apartment buildings. And so she dispatched an officer to go check it out. And he came back and he said, well, it's just some Pakistanis playing with firecrackers. And he was ready to leave it at that. But being stubborn as she is, she kind of thought that, that sounds a little suspicious. So she actually personally went to check it out. And to make a long story short, there was a foot chase, shots were fired, and she arrested... one of the conspirers, the co-conspirers of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and almost caught the mastermind, Ramzi Youssef, of the 1993 WTC bombing. And in all the computers and the files that they discovered in this apartment were blueprints, literally, for a plan that looked that in hindsight looked very much like the sort of genesis where they got the idea for 9/11. And even under interrogation, one of the culprits that she had caught already in 1995, he had gone to the United States and trained to be a pilot and had gotten his pilot's license in North Carolina, I think it is. And he had said, well, the only thing right now, the problem we have right now, we want to crash these planes in the buildings, but we don't know. The problem we have right now is we don't have enough trained pilots. And later, when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which is one of who was captured last year, one of the key 9/11 planners, admitted under interrogation that, in fact, he'd gone to Manila and talked to Murad and Ramzi Youssef, and this, who was his nephew. And this was, in fact, the sort of where they got the idea for 9/11. And the interesting part of that story, of course, is that the FBI and the CIA were brought in by the Filipino police and military on these interrogations. They were given the transcripts of these interrogations. They were given access to the computers and the encrypted files on these computers. And so they knew as far back as 1995 that there was some sort of plan afoot to train pilots, and at that time they were saying they were going to fill Cessnas with dynamite and crash them into things like CIA headquarters and possibly and Congress and possibly some tall, quote, tall buildings. But the plans were sort of very loose at that point. But still, the American intelligence was apprised of this and knew about it and sort of, filed it and forgot about it. And so when, following 9/11, this, we were told, well, this was really out of the blue. There was no way to predict this, September 11th and this sort of attack. That's not entirely true. Their signs went back as far as the mid-1990s.
You talked to the inspector who went to the site of this little explosion that led to the discovery of these files and of the people behind this plan. What did she tell you about her frustrations, knowing that the Philippine authorities had passed all this information on to American authorities back in the mid-90s?
She put it hubris, that they didn't want to listen to us, that we're just, you know, this is big, great America, and we're just a little Filipinos, third world country, and they didn't want to listen to us. And she felt, you know, frustration. She felt anger. This was clearly for her, in terms of her career. This was the highlight of her career. This was, you know, and breaking up this plot, which at the time also saw to this, the chemical, the explosion. They were making a sort of a nitroglycerin type of derivative bomb that was undetectable by the screening equipment at the time. And they had planned on putting it on 11 airliners, U.S. airliners, to detonate at the same time over the Pacific. So you would have had thousands and thousands of people dead. And so, you know, she had saved all these people's lives. And you know, clearly she was extraordinarily proud of this. And then she turned on her television and saw 9/11 and said, oh, my God, this operation was called Bojinka. It's Bojinka. They, you know, and so there was indignation, there was frustration, anger. So all her efforts, she felt, were maybe in the end for naught, and nobody listened to her.
You've concluded that the Department of Homeland Security has been treated like a political football, that it's underfunded, and that, you know, we're spending proportionally too much on Iraq and not nearly enough on Homeland Security. Other people would say, you know, people who support the Bush administration's approach would say, look, bottom line, there hasn't been a terrorist attack within the borders of the United States since September 11th, so they must be doing something right.
Not necessarily at all. I mean, I think, of course, they have made a lot of progress and they have done some things right. There's no question about that. But just because this is very dangerous and this is where, you know, this is where efforts wane and we start resting on our laurels, congratulating ourselves that there hasn't been an attack. Well, 9/11 took really, if the genesis was 1995, and then they sort of seriously in earnest started really working on it in 98, you know, that took years. Terrorist operations take years to plan.
Well, Matthew Brzezinski, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Matthew Brzezinski is the author of the new book, Fortress America. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by The Dial Press, publisher of Sweet and Vicious, a modern love story about a tough guy on the run and the outrageous woman who tames his soul, by David Schickler, author of Kissing in Manhattan, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
During the Cold War, Norman Podhoretz decided he was no longer a liberal and became one of the founders of neoconservatism. This year, he received a Presidential Medal of Freedom. He supports the war in Iraq as essential to winning the war on terror. Coming up, we talk with him about his life and his politics. And linguist Jeff Nunberg compares how we describe Democrats and Republicans.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Norman Podhoretz used to describe himself as a radical, but by the late 60s, he had become disillusioned with what he's described as the anti-American tone of the left's political and anti-war protests. When Podhoretz had his political transformation, he became a founding father of neoconservatism. His friend and fellow neocon, Irving Kristol, defined neoconservative as a liberal who has been mugged by reality. Podhoretz is now in his mid-70s. This year, he was one of 13 winners of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He continues to write for Commentary, the journal that he edited for many years. His current piece is called World War IV, How It Started, What It Means, and Why We Have to Win. He uses World War III to refer to the Cold War and World War IV to refer to the War on Terror. He believes the war in Iraq is an essential part of the War on Terror. I asked him if his support has been affected by some of the problematic aspects of the war. For example, we haven't found weapons of mass destruction. We continue to fight insurgents. Fallujah and Ramadi are now controlled by fundamentalist militias. And with the pictures of torture in Abu Ghraib, those who hate Americans can now reinforce that hatred with the image of Americans torturing Muslims. Does he still think the war was the right thing to do?
Absolutely. I have no second thoughts. I think it was the right thing to do. And I think that on the whole, the operation has been not a failure or a disaster, as many people keep saying, I think mindlessly, but a huge success as measured by historical analogies.
What are the measures you're using?
Well, talking about, I was in the Army of Occupation in Germany. I was just an enlisted man, and I was there at the tail end. But still old enough now to remember the difficulties that faced us in Germany and Japan after the Second World War. They were not the same kind of difficulties, but there were many. Not only were there many difficulties, but there were articles saying that what we were trying to do there was impossible. It could not be done. You could not create or foster democratic societies either in Germany or Japan for this, that, and the other reason, pointing to all the things that were going wrong, and many things were going wrong. Things always go wrong, not only in war, but in the efforts to reconstruct a war-torn society. And anyone with a historical sense who measures the difficulties, the costs, the problems of the what I call the Battle of Iraq, would have to say that the price in blood was very low, again by historical standards. We lost several hundred troops, including the occupation period or the Reconstruction period. 6,600 Americans were killed on a single day in D-Day, just to supply a bit of perspective here. And I could give you similar numbers for other wars that we fought. So I would stipulate, yes, I mean, not only have there been problems, some of them will continue to be problems, but the question that one always has to ask is compared to what and measured against what standard and what the balance sheet is. So I myself not only don't have any second thoughts, I think that President Bush made the right decision. It was a decision backed by a majority in Congress, and I think he is being vindicated and that the policy will be vindicated.
In your latest piece in the publication Commentary, you wrote, "The road we have taken since 9/11 is the only safe course for us to follow."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was just trying to say.
Yeah, I'm going to quote a little more. We are only in the very early stages of what promises to be a very long war, and Iraq is only the second front to have opened in that war, the second scene, so to speak, of the first act of a five-act play. What are the other acts? What do you think is next in this scenario? And does that include the invasion of other countries?
Well, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, I'm not actually making policy in detail, but I can describe the strategy to you that I think is being followed and that I support. When I say it's a very long war, I have in mind the analogy with World War III or the Cold War, which took 42 years from the enunciation of the Truman Doctrine to the fall of the Berlin Wall, which is pretty much marks the end of it, the American victory in the Cold War. I think, and I'm not alone in thinking this, many people think this, that the war that into which we were plunged on 9/11 will take a comparably long time. I don't know exactly how long, but it's a long struggle. And like the Cold War, World War III, it will involve the use of many different instrumentalities of power, not just military. It's just the same thing happened in the Cold War. Economic pressures, political pressures, diplomatic, various used as appropriate in a given situation and in dealing with a given despotism that we're trying to reform or, if necessary, get overthrown. In Iran, for example, there is a very large insurgency, calls itself a democratic insurgency, that wants to overthrow the theocracy set up by the mullahs in Tehran. I still hope, it's been repressed for the moment, suppressed and repressed, that it will be possible for that insurgency to make its own way without direct American intervention, because I think it's one of the next scenes or acts in this five-act play would have to be a change of regime in Iran. I think the same is true of Syria. Now, again, military action, if we're lucky, won't be necessary or even desirable. I mean, we've seen a change in Libya without military action. I mean, Gaddafi said he was giving up his nuclear program because he was afraid he might be next on the American hit list. That's good. That's a plus, a bonus demonstration effect from Afghanistan and Iraq. But I would say that at the end of this war, if you're asking me what would happen in the last scene of Act Five, we would see the despotisms that currently oppress and dominate the lives of most of the millions and millions of people in that region in the Middle East would be replaced by regimes that at best would be democratic and at worst would be on the road to the building of democratic institutions.
Before the invasion of Iraq, one argument that was put forward is that if we invaded Iraq, ousted Saddam Hussein, and helped to create a democracy there, that democracy would spread, and that this would have a powerful and positive force on peace in the Middle East, and that mm-hmm. that it would benefit security in Israel, which I know is an important issue for you. So, mm-hmm. having come this far, what do you think the impact is so far on security in the Middle East?
What you already see happening throughout that region is a lot of talk about democratic reform, none of which existed before. It's all over the place, and it's quite extraordinary. It's a clear consequence of the Bush Doctrine in action in that region. Reformers have been heartened, just as dissidents behind the Iron Curtain were heartened by Ronald Reagan when he talked of the evil empire. That's one effect, one benevolent, you might say, domino effect. I mentioned Gaddafi before. As for the Arab war against Israel, well, what's one of the things that's happened is that there's an internal rebellion against Yasser Arafat, which has been squelched for the moment, but something that would have been unthinkable a couple of years ago. I think that the Bush Doctrine is also responsible for that. There can only be a settlement, as the president has said, if there is a Palestinian state that renounces terrorism and that is pledged to the building of democratic institutions. That would then make it possible to live, coexist in peace with Israel. That does not yet exist. It never has existed before. And until it exists, there will be no hope for an end to that particular war. But I would like to remind you, and it's a long there have been something like 23 wars in the region since the founding of Israel, in which Israel had no part whatsoever, and several million people have been killed in those wars. So the idea that peace in the Middle East is the same thing as a resolution of the conflict between the Arab world and Israel, the war of the Arab world against Israel, is ridiculous. Which doesn't mean that it's not important that that peace be brought to and security to Israel. Of course it's important.
My guest is Norman Podhoretz, one of the founders of neoconservatism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Norman Podhoretz, one of the founders of neoconservatism. Now, I know that you see the war in Iraq as being a very important part on the war on terrorism, which you describe as World War IV. But, you know, critics of the war are arguing that we're not stopping terrorism. We're creating more terrorists because what we're doing there is going so poorly and is angering so many people in that part of the world that it's becoming this incredible recruiting tool for al-Qaeda and other Islamist groups. What's your response to that?
My response to that is that it's a preposterous argument. Al-Qaeda attacked us before we were in Iraq and after a period when we were being, in effect, very nice to the regimes in that region. We are not creating al-Qaeda terrorists. We're killing a lot of al-Qaeda terrorists, and we're crippling their operation, again, not just militarily, but with use of economic power and political power. So I just think it's a silly argument, and it doesn't hold any water.
In terms of homeland security and actually protecting us against terrorists here in the United States, we're spending a fraction on homeland security that we're spending on actually fighting the war in Iraq. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's an article in Mother Jones by Matthew Brzezinski, who has a new piece on a new book on homeland security, and this article is on homeland security. And he argues that, you know, we're spending so little on homeland security compared to what we're spending on the war in Iraq, and that it's leaving us vulnerable and unable to fund what we need in protecting our transportation systems, protecting our chemical plants, our nuclear plants, our coasts, and so on. Mm-hmm. He also has a chart in this, and on one column is the spending that we need for protection. And another column is marked Iraq spending equivalent. In other words, how many days of spending in Iraq would it take to fund what we need? So in the spending needed, the amount of money for basic security upgrades for subway and commuter trains in large cities is estimated at $6 billion. We don't have that money. We're only getting $100 million from the Bush administration. But that $6 billion is only 20 days of spending in the war in Iraq. Does that seem lopsided to you? Do you think that the spending on the war in Iraq is taking away from the money that we need to defend ourselves at home?
I think the whole argument is silly. Look, I would have bet everything I own 3 years ago that we would have been attacked by now and in a major way. And I thank God that we haven't been, and of course we could be tomorrow. But somebody is doing something right. I have no idea, nor do I think he does, of how much money we really need to spend. We need to spend as much as we need to spend in order to remain secure. And so far, we have got through a period when almost everybody in the world would have expected we would be attacked. We have not been attacked. So I repeat, someone is doing something right.
Now, I've wondered about this. You support the Bush administration. And an important part of his base comes from the Christian right. And mm-hmm. many of the people on the Christian right believe that Christianity is the only true religion. And that at the end of days, which many people on the Christian right believe is imminent, that millions of people will be, that millions of born-again Christians will be instantly raised into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone who is not a Christian believer will be left on earth to face 7 years of tribulation, wars, plagues, and other catastrophes until the final battles mm-hmm. between Jesus, who will have come again, and the Antichrist.
Mm-hmm.
And that any Jews who have not converted to Christianity will never be saved.
Yeah. Well, that, first of all, that's one segment of the so-called religious right, and by no means the central one. But I don't even want to get into their theology. As my friend and fellow founding neocon father Irving Kristol once said, when the second coming materializes or happens, we'll find out whether this is true or not. And in the meantime, to the extent that these people are our friends and allies, we should accept them as such. And that's how I feel about most of the people I know who are identified with, who are conservative Christians.
It doesn't bother you that for some of them, your religion is a false religion?
Well, sure, it bothers me, but I have to say that if you press me, I mean, you know, I don't think Christianity is the true religion. Does it bother them? I suppose it does. But we've learned how to live with these differences in our society. It's taken hundreds of years, but we have finally reached a point where we understand how to coexist and tolerate one another's religious and theological beliefs.
On this week of the Republican convention, I'm wondering that when you watch conventions now on television...
I don't.
You don't?
No, I didn't watch the Democratic convention, but I'll probably watch some of this. I don't know. I mean, I watch Kerry's speech, but that's all.
Well, you're so involved in American political thought. Why are you not paying much attention to the conventions?
Well, for the same reason that the networks aren't paying much attention to them. They're not what they used to be, and they're just big shows. Nothing of great significance happens at them, which was not true in the past. I mean, in the past there was a lot of suspense. There were platform fights that really meant something. There was a question of who would be chosen vice presidential candidate, you know, that kind of thing, which delegations would be seated. Nothing like that happens. The whole thing is now predetermined, and the only question is whether the candidate makes a really effective speech. I think that's about all that's left.
The literature about the neoconservative movement makes it seem that when you had your conversion from liberal or radical to conservative, that it meant parting ways with a lot of your liberal or radical friends.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, many years beyond that transformation, do you have friends who are liberal?
No. I mean, I do. You know, I have acquaintances who are liberal and with whom I have civil relations of having to run into them at dinner parties. But I have almost no friends any longer who are liberal, and I suspect that this is true of most people on both sides of the divide. I've never seen, well, I mean, since the 60s, the polarization has become more and more intense, and there are fewer and fewer friendships that can be sustained across the divide between left and right in this country. It's a great shame, but it's a reality. I wrote a book called Ex-Friends all about this, about my own experience, and tried to explain why it was so difficult for people who take political ideas really seriously to maintain friendships with people who have other points of view. I mean, what religious differences used to be and aren't anymore, in our world, not in the Muslim world, political differences have become. They've acquired a religious intensity and are tinged with a kind of intolerance that used to characterize religious differences, and that characterize religious differences far less now than they characterize political differences.
But in some places, it's a combination of the two, that the political differences are also religiously based.
Yeah, well, it depends, again, I mean, which places you're looking at. To me, the stridency of the liberal community, so-called liberal community, it's not liberal at all in any traditional sense, The stridency and intolerance and bigotry that I find marking the liberal community reminds me of the bad old days of religious intolerance of a century or two ago. I don't find anything like that degree of bigotry, really, among religious people. I do find it among some conservatives, yeah, but not among most religious people I happen to know.
Do you think that James Carville and Mary Matlin should be giving us all lessons in how to get along?
Well, I've often said nobody knows what goes on inside someone else's marriage, and that marriage is a great mystery to me. And how they get along, I really don't know. I mean, it would be very nice if we could all get along, but in the real world, it doesn't seem to work that way.
Norman Podhoretz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Norman Podhoretz has an article in the current edition of Commentary called World War IV, How It Started, What It Means, and Why We Have to Win. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg compares how we describe Democrats and Republicans. This is Fresh Air. The Republicans are featuring a lot of moderate speakers at their convention this week. When the Democrats did the same thing last month, the speakers were described more often as centrists. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about the curious differences in the language we use to describe the two parties.
By their uniforms, you shall know them. The New York Times' Damian Cave begins an article on the Republican convention by saying, "They're finally here, the Republican delegates in their rep ties." Daniel Perez, the editor of Details magazine, explains why he's leaving the city for the duration. "I don't want to see a lot of bad Men's Warehouse suits and a lot of badly parted hair walking around my neighborhood." New York magazine offers tips to women conventioneers on where to buy coordinated skirt suits and high-end hairspray. And the Weekly Standard's Mark Labash worries that in New York, Republicans will stand out like good humor men in their summer weight khaki suits. Unfair or not, those dress stereotypes have a long history. The phrase "white shoe Republicans" goes back to the Reagan years. Or you think of the Checkers speech that Richard Nixon gave during the 1952 campaign when he famously referred to his wife Pat's respectable Republican cloth coat. What's curious is that people don't pigeonhole the Democrats that way. Liberals, yes, with their Volvos, lattes, and Birkenstocks. But the Democratic Party in general gets a sartorial pass. The picture of a Republican uniform reflects a wider perception of the party's uniformity, not just in appearance, but in ideology. It's a difference that shows up in the words we use to describe the parties. When the Republicans wanted to put a compassionate face on their party for the convention, they decided to feature speakers like Rudy Giuliani, Arnold Schwarzenegger, George Pataki, and Michael Bloomberg. That pretty much mirrors the strategy the Democrats adopted at their convention, when they tried to appeal to swing voters with speakers like Senator John Breaux of Louisiana and Barack Obama of Illinois. The difference is that the Republican speakers tended to be called moderates, whereas the Democrats are called centrists. In fact, when politicians are described as centrists, the odds are around 4-1 they're Democrats. When they're described as moderates, the odds are 4-1 they're Republicans. That's part of a general pattern. People tend to place Democrats relative to the broad political spectrum and Republicans relative to their party. In press stories, for example, the phrase "mainstream Republican" is 3 times more common than "mainstream Democrat" is.
Those discrepancies are a fairly recent development. The phrase moderate Republican didn't become common until the 1964 election. At the time, it implied a contrast with the extremist label that Democrats were trying to pin on Barry Goldwater and his supporters. But the phrase persisted even after conservative Republicanism became respectable in the Reagan era. When Tom DeLay jokes about how many moderates the Republican Party has, he obviously isn't contrasting moderates with radicals or extremists. Nowadays, being a moderate Republican is usually a matter of what position you take on social issues, or sometimes just a matter of tone. Moderate Republicans are like other Republicans, only less intense about it. The triumph of moderate Republican owes a lot to the near disappearance of the phrase liberal Republican, which is about 80% less common in the press than it was in Goldwater's day. That's partly a result of the party's general drift to the right. But the fact is that a lot of the speakers who were featured at the convention would probably have been described as liberal Republicans in the 1960s. Since then, though, the polarization of political life has been turning the L word into an absolute rather than a relative term. Nowadays, Republicans like Pataki and Bloomberg wouldn't own up to being a liberal anything, no more than they'd acknowledge Nelson Rockefeller or John Lindsay as their spiritual ancestors. Ever since the Reagan years, though, we've been describing the two parties according to different sets of coordinates. We define Republicans relative to the party constellation. We define Democrats according to their distance from the political horizons. That reflects the view of Republicans as having a dominant ideology, which defines the party's center and periphery. We have a word Republicanism, after all, but there's no word Democratism. For that matter, Republicans are far more likely than Democrats to be described as true believers or the party faithful. That language suggests that the Republicans are a movement, whereas the Democrats are a confluence of currents with no discernible mainstream. As Will Rogers once said, "I belong to no organized party, I'm a Democrat." This isn't to say that people don't perceive the Democrats as standing for anything nowadays. Compassionate conservatism or no, words like caring and fairness are still more likely to come up in connection with Democrats. But that's a question of common attitudes and values rather than of a political program. Despite all the efforts of the right to make Democrats synonymous with liberal, people don't associate the party with a dominant philosophical system. Those differences are natural enough given the Republicans' fabled party discipline and the Democrats' equally fabled fractiousness compounded by all those years out of power. But the perception of the Republicans' overriding ideological unity may make it hard for them to persuade undecided voters that people like Bloomberg and Schwarzenegger are the real embodiments of the party's soul. Not with all those qualifying adjectives slung around their necks, and certainly not in those fabulous suits.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and the author of Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Ian Chillog. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the German Information Center, the shortcut to Germany on the web at www.germany.info. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comedian and actor Dave Chappelle. He hosts a popular show on Comedy Central. His new comedy special premieres Saturday night on Showtime. And we meet Christian comic Brad Stein, who performs in evangelical churches and has toured with the Promise Keepers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.